From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do different kinds of scientists have different personalities? Nobel Prize-winning physicist Robert Laughlin thinks so.
Biologists are stupid, the physicists are children, and the chemists are gangsters.
Well, Robert Laughlin doesn't really believe all those things, but he does say there's something decidedly eccentric about physicists. And Mark Everett would agree. He's an indie rock star whose father was Hugh Everett, the man who came up with a theory of parallel universes.
The physicists, they're not known for being great family men. Einstein wasn't so great. And we can't really apply normal people rules to these people.
Today, we'll peel back the veil of physics and peek into the troubled life of Hugh Everett. And look back at a largely forgotten strand of Isaac Newton's life. His long fascination with alchemy. But first, a very practical take on physics. University of California, Berkeley physicist Richard Muller has written a book called Physics for Future Presidents. He says every president needs a working knowledge of physics. And I had to wonder, why do presidents need this when they're surrounded by science advisors?
I think because the science advisors are too narrow in their understanding. Some of these issues, if the science advisor was the one who made the decision, wouldn't necessarily get the economics, the business aspects of it right, the diplomacy. The president can get advice from the scientists, but that advice will always reflect the scientists' narrower knowledge. The president has to put it all together. I think the president needs to understand the science and certainly can understand the science.
At least so that he can understand what they're telling him when they have their narrow view of the issues?
That's right. That's right. They can understand the essence of nuclear weapons, of energy, of terrorist threats. They can really understand those. That's my point.
Well, let's talk about one of those threats. Nuclear weapons seems like a pretty obvious place to start. An atomic bomb would be devastating. But what about a dirty bomb? We hear a lot more about that falling into the hands of terrorists.
Well, dirty bombs, it turns out, are extremely difficult to make. When Jose Padilla, the Chicago street thug, came to the U.S. planning to make a dirty bomb, it turns out it's very hard. And the reason is that if you make it too radioactive, it's very hard to transport, very hard to work on. You'll kill the terrorist before you deploy the bomb. If you make it less radioactive, then he can deploy it, maybe die in the process. But when you spread it out, the radioactive level gets below a threshold for death. There's still a long-term cancer danger. But if you spread it out over more than a few hundred yards, then the human response to that level of radioactivity is no illness whatsoever, no dead bodies at the scene. So, in fact, Al-Qaeda instructed Jose Padilla to abandon the dirty bomb idea and instead to blow up some apartment houses using natural gas.
Well, you know, before we leave this, though, that's not the public perception at all of this. A dirty bomb sounds really bad.
Yeah. And in fact, what frightens me is that I think Al-Qaeda understands this issue better than does the U.S. government, which has listed a dirty bomb as a weapon of mass destruction. Don't confuse a dirty bomb with a nuclear explosion. In a dirty bomb, you have a conventional explosion, maybe dynamite or TNT, that spreads radioactivity. It's like spreading a carcinogen. If you really wanted to do damage, you would make a dirty bomb that wouldn't spread radioactivity, but would spread botulism toxin, some other poison that's even worse than radioactivity.
When you talk about a nuclear explosion, you say in your book that a president needs to know the difference between a plutonium bomb and a uranium bomb. I'm not sure that I understand the difference. Do the terrorists?
Well, if they're trying to make a bomb, they'll discover that uranium, the kind you need, has to be purified, and that's very, very difficult to get. Plutonium is relatively easy to get if you have a nuclear reactor. So one is easy to get, the other isn't. On the other hand, the one that's easy to get, the plutonium, very difficult to make a bomb out of it. North Korea tried to make a plutonium bomb. They spent billions of dollars. They starved their own people to get the money to do this, and it was basically a fizzle. The North Korean plutonium bomb released the energy of 400 tons of TNT. That's less than the energy released when the 9/11 terrorists crashed an airplane into one of the Twin Towers. So nukes are really hard.
Well, let's talk about energy then, which is the other great issue faced by any president in this day and age. And President Obama has said, in fact, that a revamped energy policy is going to be a cornerstone of his presidency. So what does he need to know about physics to be able to make good decisions about America's energy future?
Well, energy is important for three reasons. The first one is the obvious one, economics. We've been spending a lot of money, sending a lot of money to countries that are not necessarily friendly to the U.S. But the two key science, technology, physics issues are energy independence. That's both energy security and also making sure that we're not funding the terrorists, and also global warming. Now, you got to keep these things straight. Energy independence, if that's all we wanted, we have huge amounts of coal. And we could switch over from being an oil economy to a coal economy. We could also switch to natural gas. Coal, though, is the cheapest source of energy. But that really is the dirtiest source of energy with regard to global warming. Compared to natural gas, coal puts off twice as much carbon dioxide for the same energy. So these things are often in conflict with each other. And the argument gets confused. Obama says clean coal. And people say, that's an oxymoron. It doesn't make sense. There's a lot of technology in this. Clean coal is important. Energy is important. Balancing these things has a huge technology component.
So is there really such a thing as clean coal?
Oh, yes, there is. But it's not the old clean coal that people refer to, in which they have smokestacks that scrub out the sulfur and the mercury. The new clean coal is a facility in which the carbon dioxide is also removed. And that's the global warming culprit. So if you burn coal, which is still our cheapest fuel, but you grab the carbon dioxide when it comes out and bury it deep underground, that's what Obama's referring to as clean coal. And that's not an oxymoron. That is a valid concept. And given the fact that China and India and Russia have huge amounts of coal, that unless we develop a clean coal technology, we by ourselves cannot possibly stop the danger of global warming.
We forget that sometimes, don't we, that we can make all kinds of decisions regarding our own economy, but we can't make them in a vacuum.
People say in the United States, we have to set an example, we have to get clean. The problem with that is if our example is to use expensive technology to get clean, then it's an example that China can't afford to follow. We need not only clean, we need cheap and clean. That combination is what we need if we're going to save the world from coal.
Tell me a little bit more about this notion of cleaning the carbon dioxide out of clean coal and burying it deep underground. I don't quite understand how that's done.
Well, it's a new technology, and the critics will say it's not proven. But actually, nothing in this business is proven. Cheap solar isn't proven either. The way it works is the carbon dioxide as it comes out of the ground is compressed and pumped into regions deep underground that are rather common across the U.S. and around the world. They're called deep salt brines. If we pump the carbon dioxide into them, it would stay there for, as near as we can tell, hundreds of thousands of years.
What about the types of clean energy that are more obvious, the things we can see, solar power, wind energy? Are those really energy sources that can supply most of America's energy needs?
I think so. And I think they're coming very rapidly. Part of the problem with solar and wind is the energy storage issue. So people are working on storage technology, new kinds of batteries for doing that. In some types of solar plants, you could actually just store the heat and then take the energy out during the day. The problem right now, particularly with solar, is it is much more expensive than coal. But there are new technologies that are developing. I'm very optimistic about solar. There's expensive solar, but there's some inexpensive solar cells that are under development. And I think the idea of having tax subsidies to support this industry, to develop these new technologies, is something that should be part of the policy, because I believe it's very likely that 20 years from now, a very large fraction of our electrical power will come from solar.
So what's the first thing we should do about energy?
Well, conservation. I hate to say that word because there's such a negative impact to it. The fact is, under the Carter administration, people believe conservation means discomfort. But it shouldn't. It's the best investment you can make. You invest money in insulation in your home, and you'll get a 15% real return on energy saved. That's better than Madoff was promising, and that was a farce. This is real. We can do things with better light bulbs. The light bulbs, the compact fluorescent light bulbs, are truly wonderful. In fact, many people haven't noticed this, which I think is a good sign, but they have now replaced candles in Notre Dame de Paris. They are in their chandeliers in the cathedral, compact fluorescent light bulbs. They are beautiful.
What do you think about nuclear energy? Do you think it's time to reevaluate nuclear power plants?
Well, back in the 1970s, nuclear was put on hold, largely because natural gas, we found abundant sources of that, and it was cheap. We believed at that time that fossil fuels, oil, did no harm to the environment. They just put clean carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and there was no real downside. Now we know better. Some of us knew better back then, but now the public recognizes that the downsides of oil are not only global warming, carbon dioxide is not so benign, but also war in the Mideast. It leads to conflict. Most people believe we would not be in war right now if the Middle East were not the keystone of the oil region. So given this, it's time to come to grips with nuclear. Now, at the time that nuclear was abandoned, it was not really considered that dangerous by the experts, but it required an educational campaign to teach the public what the experts already knew. Now I think we have to reevaluate it, as you suggested. And I believe when we reevaluate it, people will decide that the one remaining issue, the one that they worry about, nuclear waste storage, has been exaggerated and is not as bad as people think it is.
Plutonium is not as big a problem as we've been led to believe?
That's right. Think of it this way. There are several ways. One is that plutonium is less than 100 times less toxic than Botox when ingested. And that's what people worry about. They worry about groundwater. Plutonium is very insoluble in groundwater. The other radioactivities, which are soluble and do present a potential problem, don't last that long. Typically, they're vastly reduced after 100, 150 years. So if you really look at it from a risk point of view, you realize that the dangers of this are much less than the dangers that we're facing from oil and coal and natural gas.
You've called your book Physics for Future Presidents. You've talked a lot about what you hope and believe Barack Obama will do. Do you know if he has seen your book?
Well, I know it's in the hands and liked by several of his closest advisors. The one I'm most optimistic about was that a friend of mine, mutual friend, did hand it to Michelle Obama. And Michelle looked at it and said, my husband will enjoy this. He loves to read, unlike some past presidents. So I know at least it is in the home, and I'm optimistic that he will read it. I think the president of the United States needs to really understand these issues as much as he needs to understand economics, finance, diplomacy, and politics.
Richard Mueller, thank you very much.
Delighted to be here.
Richard Mueller teaches physics at the University of California, Berkeley. His book is called Physics for Future Presidents. What do you think the president needs to know about physics? You can send us email to our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Robert Laughlin is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist at Stanford University. He's written various popular books, including A Different Universe and The Crime of Reason and the Closing of the Scientific Mind. Laughlin has a rather quirky view of his fellow physicists, as Steve Paulson discovered.
Once I was in Finland giving a talk, and I felt a little pesky, so I confessed to this big auditorium of students that I made explosives when I was a kid. And I probably shouldn't admit it now because they'll lock you up as a terrorist, but I was just rather curious how many people in the audience made explosives as kids. They all raised their hands. Now, I didn't have a room full of terrorists. What I had was a room full of mostly young men who went through their teenage power thing and were very smart and experimented. Now, you'll find that people who choose an artistic life, which is what this is, tend to be, well, eccentric, as I said, but also obsessed with knowing lots of things.
Why physicists, though? I mean, why does this particular scientific discipline seem to encourage this kind of oddball behavior? I'm guessing more so than, say, in biology or in the medical sciences, you know, that kind of thing.
Why is the sky blue? People are different. Societies are different. Disciplines are different. Probably the answer is the bomb. You know, the lurid fascination of that attracted a certain kind of person, and then the culture got embedded in the discipline and stuck. But that's just a guess. The more objective response is that the various disciplines of science have personalities. When I was in Korea, I had an official explain to me the difference of the scientists. Now, this is not my words. This is an official. He says, well, I can explain science to you very easy. He says that biologists are stupid, the physicists are children, and the chemists are gangsters. Now, if you know any chemists, you laugh immediately because I think that's pretty true. Most of the chemists I know that actually are gangsters. So he was trying to explain that the physicists were very artistic people, interested in lots of things, but perhaps not as practical as they ought to be. And the chemists were a little bit too practical. And everybody likes to trash the biologists because the biologists are winning.
And you also say that physicists are culturally the exact opposite of doctors.
Right. And the objective there, of course, is to start fights. We're not, of course, exact opposite. In fact, most of my readers, it's very interesting, I get lots of fan mail from doctors. When you're doing medicine, you have to worry about business a lot. You cannot worry about fundamentals. You don't have time. If you worry about fundamentals, the person will be dead. Good doctors, anyway, the good ones, make people healthy as quickly as possible, as cheaply as possible, and move on to the next patient. Physics, by contrast, isn't patient-oriented, or it's completely impractical, partly because the practical parts of physics are too dangerous. Also, it has a streak of pure intellectualism and fun that is both heartwarming and a little dangerous. And you find that as people age in the discipline, things begin happening to them that aren't so nice, just like happens to everybody else. And very often the person becomes bitter, having thrown their body in front of the freight train for art, now finds that they're not protected economically anymore. The value of science that I value, and that I think most people do also, is the artistic part, the childlike part. That's the part you don't want to throw away. And the good news is I've discovered that artistic part refreshes itself like grass growing in the spring. Every generation comes forward filled with ideas because they can't help themselves. Hmm. It's rather wonderful. I love being a professor.
So if most physicists played with explosives when they were teenagers, what's the equivalent of when they're older in their careers? Is there an equivalent to playing with explosives?
No, I don't think so. I've worked with an awful lot of teenage people and 20-year-old people, and I now understand that when you're in your 20s, that's your artistic period. You're completely narcissistic. You're obsessed with yourself and all the things you can do and all the things you might do and all the wonderful things you can create. After that comes child-rearing years, where it's opposite now. You have to serve somebody younger than yourself and do a bunch of stuff you don't want to do in order to bring home enough money to support them. So what normally happens to people as they enter the economy is they get very, very serious when they get into their childbearing years because they can't be artistic anymore. Now, this is not a revelation to anybody. I'm just happily reporting that life in science is not so different from life anywhere else. And then when the kids are grown up and earning money, which mine are now, life gets very happy again, and maybe it's time for second childhood.
I'm still in the child-rearing phase, so I know what you're talking
about. Ha, 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 ha.
Robert Laughlin is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist at Stanford University.
Hugh Everett's theory was so bold that it set him on a collision course with the most brilliant minds of the physics world. Taken to the extreme, parallel universes would mean that with every event that could happen in more ways than one, universes branch off in different directions. That means that moment to moment, we divide into multiple versions of ourselves.
It's an excerpt from the documentary Parallel Worlds, Parallel Lives. It's the story of Hugh Everett, the troubled genius who, at the age of 24, gave birth to the theory of parallel universes. It's the crazy idea that anything that can happen is happening at the quantum level of reality. It's a radical concept, but one that's become a staple of science fiction and is now accepted by a surprising number of today's physicists. Back in the mid-50s, when Hugh Everett came up with the idea, no one paid much attention. And Everett ended up drifting away from physics and died young. His son, Mark Oliver Everett, never really knew his father, but recently he's made an effort to understand this mysterious figure from his childhood. And I should say that Mark knows next to nothing about physics. He's an indie rock star, better known as E, the lead singer of the band The Eels. He's also written a memoir called Things the Grandchildren Should Know. And he's the on-camera guide for the documentary about his dad. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Mark Everett to talk about his father.
Today, your father is celebrated for his revolutionary theory of parallel universes. Did you have any idea that he was some sort of scientific genius?
Not really when I was growing up. It was something I was very vaguely aware of, but he was a complete mystery in every way. I didn't really understand it until after he died, and the phone started ringing with what I called physics groupies who were calling my mom to grill her for information about my father. And as the years went on and the technology caught up with his theory, they started to take him more and more seriously. And now it's 50 years later and it checks out really well.
Mm-hmm. So what kinds of memories do you have of your father as you were growing up?
Well, he was like a piece of furniture to me, really. I mean, it's odd because, you know, the most common situation is where there's an absent father and, you know, they leave the family. In this case, he was always a physical presence until I was 19. He was there every night. But that's what's so odd about it is I just couldn't tell you anything about what he was like. He was just sort of this lump on a chair.
So you never really talked to him?
Very rarely. It was always, you know, considered a real novelty to my sister and I whenever he did really speak much or emote.
And then when you were 19, you discovered his body after he died.
Well, that was a particularly surreal experience for me because I realized, you know, I was on the phone with the 911 operator and she's teaching me how to do CPR and I had to pick his body up off the bed and put it on the floor. And it just was so strange to me that I was touching my father because I couldn't remember us ever actually touching.
Hmm. And your troubles with your family didn't just end with your father. You had one sibling, an older sister, Liz, whom you looked up to a great deal. But she had all kinds of problems, didn't she?
Yeah, and she ended up committing suicide eventually.
And you found her as well, not dead, but you found her once nearly dead after she'd swallowed a whole bottle of pills.
Yeah, the same summer that I found my father, just before that, I had found my sister on the bathroom floor from her first attempt at suicide.
Did you wonder whether you were going to turn out like she did?
Yeah. You know, it's something that still haunts me. You feel at some point when your whole family has died, you start to wonder if there's some sort of curse or something. But I was really lucky in that I got music and it literally saved my life. And I think both of us, my sister and I, were just two sides of the same coin. And I just got lucky that I got obsessed with music and put all my energy into that. And it gave me a purpose in my life. And she didn't have anything like that.
Life is good. And I feel great. 'Cause mother says I was a great mistake. Love came for the soul. Better give me something to fill the hole before I sputter out.
You obviously had a rough childhood in all kinds of ways. We could also add that you talk about how miserable you were at school during most of those years. But then you say that some of the most horrible moments of your life have led to some of the best.
Well, that's the kind of thing that keeps me an optimist. You go through these terrible situations and then good things can, you know, rise up from the ashes. In my mind, when I really became like a real artist was after the first album I made with the Eels was very popular, I started to get disgusted with what the music world was all about. And I decided that I was going to make an album about the tragedies in my family. And everybody around me was against the idea and said, nobody's going to want to hear an album about all this death and despair. But I knew that I could do it and actually put a positive spin on it. And not only did I feel like an artist for the first time, but I felt like a man, you know. I felt like that's when I grew up, you know.
Mama gripped onto the milkman's hand, and then she finally gave birth. Years go by, still I don't know who shall inherit this earth.
Recently, you worked with a BBC crew to do a documentary about your father, Hugh Everett, this pioneer of the many worlds theory of quantum physics, a man you hardly knew. Did you come to appreciate him all these years after he died?
Yeah, it was just the best experience for me. I really went into it with trepidation. I didn't have any idea what to expect. And I learned so much about my father to have the opportunity to get to go back to Princeton where he wrote his theory and walk around the campus with his three roommates who are all still alive that were with him when he was writing it. Everybody should be so lucky to get to make a documentary about their father. It was an absolutely healing process for me. It led to me being able to forgive him for his shortcomings as a father because I started to understand why he was the way he was.
Why was he the way he was?
Well, I think his life ultimately was quite tragic because he wasn't taken seriously. He was a 24-year-old kid who came up with this theory that was so ahead of its time, and the faces on the Mount Rushmore of physics weren't about to be knocked off by this 24-year-old kid. So they just brushed him under the carpet.
Well, and in fact, this documentary recounts what must have been a remarkable episode when he went off to Copenhagen. I mean, he's still in his 20s. He goes to meet Niels Bohr, the greatest physicist in the world at that time, the reigning champion of quantum physics. And your father presents this theory, which contradicted what Niels Bohr thought. But
right.
That meeting didn't go well, did it?
No. And you could say my father was quite naive in thinking that Bohr was going to accept his theory because that would mean that Bohr's theory was now void, you know, so it was a crazy idea to expect that to happen.
So after all this happened, your father basically dropped out of the academic world.
Yeah, he just gave up. That was it.
22 miles of hard road, 33 years of tough luck, 44 skulls buried in the ground, crawling down through the muck. Oh, yeah.
What was it like to meet some of the people who knew your father?
It was great. It was fascinating. And, you know, now I feel like I know what he was like.
What did they say about him?
You know, your typical genius type of personality. You know, the physicists, they're not known for being great family men. Einstein wasn't so great. And we can't really apply normal people rules to these people. Their minds are not. You know, my memory of him was he was always sitting at the dining room table with a yellow legal pad just scribbling endless physics notations all night. That's what he would do. He'd get up and go to the bathroom and you look at the pad of paper and it just looked like Chinese, you know. It was the craziest stuff.
Now, you are obviously not a physicist yourself, but have you come to understand his theory of parallel universes?
Well, one thing I didn't inherit whatsoever from my father was the math gene. Somehow that skipped me. And that was another thing that was great about making the documentary was they do such a good job of explaining what that means and how it works.
In the winter of 1954, sometime after the Bohr lecture, fortified by some sherry and a chat with Bohr's assistant, Augie Peterson, Hugh came up with the theory of parallel universes. Hugh argued that everything in the universe, big and small, obeys the laws of quantum mechanics. And instead of the observer, Hugh introduced the notion of splitting. Splitting occurs every time a quantum event happens, and this is how parallel universes are created.
Now, another thing that you say is you've come to realize that both you and your father were idea men, that you become obsessed with ideas and pretty much everything that's not becomes a distraction.
Yeah, that's the main way that I identify with my father. I tend to be very isolated in a lot of ways, like he was. And I get it now, you know, that you're just about to crack the code and the kid wants to go play baseball. And, you know, I understand now.
I'm turning out just like my father, though I swore I never would. Now I can say that I have love for him. I never really understood what it must have been like for him, living inside his head. I feel like he's here with me now, even though he's dead.
Mark Oliver Everett is the lead singer of the band The Eels and the author of the memoir Things the Grandchildren Should Know. He can be seen in the documentary Parallel Worlds, Parallel Lives, produced by Nova and WGBH in Boston for PBS and by the BBC in England. Mark Everett spoke with Steve Paulson. Up next, an historical novel about Isaac Newton and poetry on quantum physics. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Cambridge is a small English city drenched in history, from the wanderers who passed through the town 1,000 years ago to luminaries like Isaac Newton, who once roamed the halls of Trinity College. Rebecca Stott lives in Cambridge today, and she's made the city itself the backdrop of her historical novel Ghost Walk. It's an intellectual thriller, set partly in Newton's day, partly in our own time, and it plays with Newton's fascination with alchemy, along with more recent findings in quantum physics. Stott told Anne Strangechamps that the idea for the novel came to her one day in a flash when she went to the train station only to learn that her train had been cancelled.
I was about to go home when a man in a long black coat and a thick German accent asked whether I wanted to share a taxi. The cost would be half. If we shared a taxi to the airport, he also needed to get a plane. So we drove off through Cambridge through thick fog. It was still dark, 5 a.m. in the morning. And the light was doing very strange things with the fog, you know, the lights from the street lamps and so on. And I made some comment about how I'd heard that the day before on the radio that there was a meteor storm going on that morning. And what a shame it was that we couldn't see it because it was dark and foggy. And he said that he'd seen lots of meteor storms and they were amazing. And he turned out to be a meteorologist, which is, yeah, one of those strange things that happens in Cambridge. And so he then described what we would see. And he described it in three ways. He said it was like a giant dandelion head with all the seeds going off in different directions. And it was like a mathematical diagram, again, with all lots of little lines going off in different directions. And then the third metaphor he used was a giant entanglement in the sky. And it was that word, entanglement, I think, that was the catalyst. I began to start thinking, too, about Newton again, because I'd been reading that he followed the comets that went across the Cambridge night skies. So I suddenly thought, you know, this is the same sky that Newton would have stood and looked at. And the meteorologist fell silent, and in the 40 minutes to the station, the entire novel came to me. So I like to think that this book came out of a meteor storm.
There's so many plot strands in the book, we can't possibly talk about all of them, but one strand involves Isaac Newton's interest in or obsession with alchemy.
Mm.
That's an area that has not been that much covered by Newton's biographers. In fact, I think many of them have tried to steer clear of it. Is that right?
Yeah.
How come?
I think the Newton that we have come to revere is he's become a sort of icon of the Enlightenment, you know, icon of rationality and of empiricism. And for us, from our vantage point, alchemy looks like the remnants of some primitive superstition. But of course, alchemy was an ancient practice. It was an early form of chemistry, if you like. So Newton's, 1/6 of all of Newton's writings, and that's a vast amount, that's millions and millions and millions of words, 1/6 were alchemical in nature.
So what sort of alchemy did Newton practice? What did alchemy look like at that period?
Certainly, an alchemist would believe that all material objects, chairs, tables, bits of rock, animals, humans, were all made of the same substances, and that those were forms of kind of transmuting spirit, and that what you did when you practiced alchemy was to combine those different material elements in ways that would bring one material into fuller being. So lead could be made into gold. Humans could be made immortal. And so the kind of experiments that Newton was doing would look very similar to contemporary chemistry, you know, combining very strange combinations of base metals with fire, with water, with earth.
Could you see this partly as a mystical pursuit? Was there a spirituality
to
it?
Yes, there was, yeah. I think very much so, in the sense that the alchemist believed that in order to be a very powerful practitioner, he or she, and there were many women alchemists too, needed to be pure of spirit. We look back on it and we think, there's alchemy over here and there's science over here. That's old, this is new.
Yeah, but we think of Newton, alchemy as superstition.
Yeah. But for Newton, it was all a continuum. You know, he wanted to know certain things. He wanted to know how light was made, how color was made. And it didn't matter to him what form he took to find the answers.
Well, it reminds me that if you look at the long history of Western science, there were much earlier periods of time when mystical or religious knowledge, philosophical knowledge, and scientific knowledge were all the same thing.
Yes.
You know, we didn't make the divisions in types of knowledge that we have come to do today in the post-Enlightenment world. Though I wonder whether we're beginning to erase some of those distinctions. There are great debates these days
yes.
about science and religion or science and mysticism and ways of knowing. Yeah. How do you think what you found about Newton and alchemy might fit into some of our current debates?
Well, one of the things I do touch on not as much as I do with alchemy is quantum physics. My hero, Cameron, is a neuroscientist and he knows a great deal about quantum physics. And he reminds the heroine, Lydia, at one point that actually some of the things we're discovering now in quantum physics are way beyond what anyone could have conceived, and that even Einstein called some of these discoveries spooky, you know, really spooky, beyond, in a sense, his rational mind. And I think that's absolutely what the book is about in its two time frames, 17th century and contemporary, is an attempt to look at the ways in which we are sometimes hidebound by our own insistence on rationality, that actually there are all sorts of ways in which we know. And we know things rationally and we know things through footnotes and proof and so on, but we know things in many other ways too, experientially, emotionally. And so this book is kind of pressing at that edge. And the binaries that we've put in place between the natural and the supernatural, the normal and the abnormal, or the normal and the paranormal.
And also the ways in which we, without even realizing it, limit our knowledge, limit what we take in.
Yeah.
I mean, this makes me think of, there's a passage in the book, I should ask you to read it. Your historian, Elizabeth, takes a younger historian on a kind of tour and teaches her how to perceive the 17th century. Maybe you could read a bit
yes,
from that passage?
Yes. So yes, in this scene, Elizabeth, the historian, is taking Lydia to a fair, the site of a fair called Starbridge Fair, which had been going for thousands and thousands of years and which is now just empty land with bungalows on it. If you want to write about the 17th century, you'll have to know how it smells, Elizabeth had said. Use your imagination and get your bearings. It's September in, let's say, 1664. It's muddy, sticky underfoot. Think of the trades, the guilds who've come here. Goldsmiths, toy makers, braziers, turners, milliners, haberdashers, hatters, wig makers, drapers, pewterers, china warehouses, puppeteers and prostitutes, and among them all, coffee shops, eating houses, brandy shops. There are jugglers, acrobats and clowns. You are standing among all the tents and booths. What can you smell? Close your eyes. Manure. Brandy, the seawater smells of oyster shells, the perfumes of soaps, tar, tanning, leather, oil from wool fleeces piled around the leper chapel. Smells and perfumes mingled into each other as the sun rose. I walked through the thoroughfares, invisible to the ghostly cellars. I heard cries, accents from all over England and Northern Europe, men and women from Lancashire, Holland, Germany, Yorkshire, chicken, horses, iron, the chains of scales working. Sex, riot, and desire.
That's a lovely passage.
Thank you.
But do you think that your sensitivity to the ways in which time may work and the ways in which history is layered comes to you partly because you live in Cambridge or work in Cambridge and know it so well? It must be a place where, as your character says, history does seep and bleed from one layer into another.
Yeah, I think particularly in Cambridge, because it's such a small city, and, you know, there's a bridge, for instance, a bridge that takes one of the scenes in this book, where there's been a crossing place there for 1,300 years. So there's a sense that even, you know, in this square mile of the centre of this extraordinary place, which comes on either side of a river, people have lived for such a long time.
It makes sense to me that living where you are and with that sense of history all pervasive, that you would begin to think some about time itself and theories of time and theories of space and matter. Mm-hmm. One of the many plot strands in the book is built around the idea of entanglement, actually entanglement theory from quantum physics. Can you talk a little bit about how you used entanglement theory in writing the book?
It's always the question I dread. And I say that simply because, to be able to say anything about quantum physics is so daunting. But what I understand entanglement theory means, and I did do quite a lot of reading about it because I became so fascinated with it, is the idea that if you take two subatomic particles and they are in each other's orbit, if you like, and we're talking about something so minute here, for a significant amount of time, they become entangled. They come under each other's influence. And then if you take those two subatomic particles and send them to opposite ends of the universe, but keep one to hand, as it were, and you spin it in a particular way, the other one will shadow it. It will also spin in identical ways and at identical speed. And theoretical physicists don't really know why this is the case. But the implications from it are just extraordinary, you know. And one of the things that some theoretical physicists have wondered about is whether this entanglement of subatomic particles might work for moments in time too. And that's what makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I have a very, very strong sense that history isn't some huge distance behind us, but keeps breaking into the present all the time through our imaginations, through our memories, through our books that we read, but in all sorts of unexplainable ways as well, in ways that are ghostly but also baffling, conceptually baffling. And more as I write and the more I get to know, the more baffled I am by certain things in time, history, the way we know things. These big metaphysical questions just get bigger.
Rebecca Stott's novel is called Ghost Walk. She spoke with Anne Strangehams. A. Van Jordan has put together a collection of poems about physics. Titled Quantum Lyrics, it touches on the lives and ideas of famous physicists like Einstein and Richard Feynman. And it has another quirky element. many of the poems mix physics with comic book heroes like the Green Lantern and the Atom. Steve Paulson asked Van Jordan to read one of his poems told from the point of view of another superhero, The Flash.
The Flash reverses time. When I'm running across the city on the crowded streets to home, when, in a blur, the grass turns brown beneath my feet, the asphalt steams under every step, and the maple leaves sway on the branches in my wake, and people look in that bewildered way, in my direction, I imagine walking slowly into my past among them at a pace at which we can look one another in the eye and begin to make changes in the future from our memories of the past. The bottom of a bottomless well, you may think, but why not dream a little? Our past doesn't contradict our future. They're swatches of the same fabric stretching across our minds, one image sewn into another, like the relationship between a foot and a boot, covariant in space and time. One moves along with the other, like an actor in a shadow play, like a streak of scarlet light across the skyline of your city, sweeping the debris, which is simply confetti, candy wrappers, a can of soda, all the experience of a day discarded and now picked up, even down to the youthful screams of play that put smiles on the faces of the adults, who hear remnants of their own voices through a doorway leading back to a sunrise they faintly remember.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're playing with time travel here, and you're also using a superhero to illustrate the idea. How did you come up with the idea to combine the two?
Well, the book itself came about through an exploration of time and space, thinking mostly about the movement of time and space in poems themselves. And I thought, okay, maybe I should look at the physicists and see how they deal with this issue of temporal-spatial movement.
Now, I have to say, it's very unusual for a poet to write about physics, and you've written an entire book on the subject. Why do you find physics so interesting?
Well, I find that nowadays people are often looking for some either spiritual guidance or some other explanation for the phenomenon happening around them. And it seems that physics has become another avenue to explain that. And I've been fascinated by how many people have been curious about the workings of superstring theory and black holes and all these other things have become repopularized in popular culture. And that has allowed, I think, for material for poetry.
Do you see any similarities between what poets do and what physicists do?
Well, the thing that I found fascinating was that physicists often talk in metaphor. And in many ways, they talk in metaphor more than poets do. Einstein, for instance, he would talk about relativity, and he would say that trying to explain to the French press what this thing was and trying to explain, he said, you know, if you have a pretty girl on your lap for an hour, it feels like a minute. If you're sitting on a hot plate for a minute, it feels like an hour. And he said, that's relativity. You know, so, I mean, it's something that's as simple as that, but it brings it down to a level of understanding that is perfect clarity.
Hmm. Now, do you have a science background yourself?
I do not. And so I avoided all the math as I started to deal with this. I spent a year listening to the Feynman lectures, driving around in my car.
Richard Feynman, the great Nobel Prize-winning physicist.
Exactly. I remember listening to his lecture on symmetry, and this is probably, I mean, literally the 10th time I listened to this lecture, and finally it clicked, and I thought, oh, wow, I'm finally starting to understand science and physics, and it was the first time I had that kind of experience with science. I never felt I had any facility in it before.
So you've written a couple of prose poems about Feynman in Feynman's voice. Were you trying to write these in a way that you were inhabiting his head and inhabiting his mind?
Yeah, well, he was a real interesting guy. He was from Far Rockaway, New York, but he had a strong Brooklyn accent. I mean, this guy was a bongo player. He was a safecracker, just a real sort of alternative spirit. And in trying to find the structure or the form that would fit that voice, I thought, why not a lecture as a prose poem?
Hmm. Could you read your Feynman poem, Intro to Symmetry?
Sure. Love begins in the streets with vibration and ends behind closed doors in jealousy. Creation and destruction. What do we pray for but the equation that helps us make sense of what happens in our daily lives? What do we believe in, if not that which tells us we're alive? Sex, laughter, sweat, and equations elegant enough to figure on our fingers. Math is spirit, and spirit is faith in numbers. Both take us to the edge, but no further than we can imagine. You don't believe in math? Try to figure the velocity of Earth's orbit around the sun to land a man on the moon without it. You don't believe in God? Try to use math to calculate what the eye does every second of any given moment. If Big Blue tried to work that differential equation in our lifetime, it couldn't. Mysteries inside mysteries in our own bodies of which we can't make sense. Another world waiting for a religion or calculus to explain. Look into any mirror. It's like sitting in a theater watching a silent movie, but you're the one pantomiming your story. You think you have this world figured out, but you can't tell which hand you're using and using and using, and why do we try? You cannot solve for the use of one side of the body over the other, so there is no single voice that emits from it. You cannot solve for the harmonics of a dual body facing each other, both inquisitive. You cannot solve for the marriage of opposites, their fit, their match, their endlessness. You cannot solve for the morning stretch that calls to both sides, first this one, then that one, aligning the day. You cannot solve for the base of one hand and the treble of the other, both keeping rhythm hostage under the skin of the bongo. You cannot solve for the balance of a locked door and a safecracker's ear against it, and the move X number of clicks to the left and Y number of clicks back past to the right and back past till the latch clicks open in your mind.
A. Van Jordan's book of poems is called Quantum Lyrics. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program The Wonders of Physics, number 215A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Ann Strainchamps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.